This is Jim Inkster coming today on our Thanksgiving presentation. Jared Barnhill, an MD from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and one of the nation's authorities on autism, now affecting an estimated 1 out of 88 children born in the United States. We'll talk with Dr. Jared Barnhill. Also, Dr. Stephen Lamb. His book is Redefining Prostate Cancer. Dr. Lamb, who is director of the Men's Health Center at New York University Medical Center, will talk about the past decade, which has seen breakthroughs in clinical research and unprecedented technological advancements. And we'll hear from this year's winner of the Ernest J. Gaines Literary Award, Attica Locke. Her latest work is The Cutting Season. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our guest is Dr. Jared Barnhill, a professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill School of Medicine, and he is in the Department of Psychiatry, specializing in the diagnosis and pharmacological treatment of autism and other developmental disabilities. And he was recently in Baton Rouge. Good morning to you, Dr. Yep. Jared Barnhill.
Good morning.
Well, it's nice to talk with you, and you're involved in something that has become more prevalent, certainly in this community and all others. Why has the diagnosis of autism more prominent now in a big way than it was 20 or 30 years ago?
Well, I think it's probably a combination of things, Jim. I think one may very well be we're recognizing the disorder earlier in children we would have missed years ago. And I think the other may be that pediatricians and people in the community are better equipped and better armed with rating scales that can pick up kids that might be at risk. I think the other thing is that it may have always been a much more prevalent disorder than we thought. And the thing that's always a great concern to a lot of us is that we're not sure what role environmental toxins may be playing, so that may be another issue. But I think it's probably going to be a combination of things. It may very well be we're just smarter and we're picking it up earlier.
How wide is the spectrum? There's autism and then there's autism.
Yeah.
It's something that it varies wildly, doesn't it?
I think so. There were probably several things that are interesting. One is there were two subtypes of autism described in the 40s, actually. One was autism. The other was Asperger's syndrome. And it's kind of got fallen in the category of milder autism now. But I think what's happened over time is there's different subgroups of autism. There's probably one subgroup that's related to familial history, maybe a highly inheritable disorder. People tend to inherit the genes from parents and families and extended families. And the other may be related to other neurological diseases that, in a sense, foul up the brain function and may contribute to the syndrome. And they both look very much alike. The other thing, I think for most folks, we're picking up people with autism at the milder end of the level of intelligence. It used to be most of the people were severely impaired. Now I think a large number being recognized are people with normal intelligence.
Well, some people can function very well with autism, certainly with Asperger's syndrome. But when it's at the most obvious levels, the person is largely not functional. So where are people falling in the spectrum?
Probably, I think if you look at the actual numbers, the milder end would probably tend to have more people. The severe end's more noticeable because of the service demands. And there are people with Asperger's and higher functioning ranges of autism that get missed and show up in adult psychiatric clinics or behavioral clinics. Mm-hmm. And we're never noticed. And somebody says, oh, by the way, this is what this looks like. And there's some psychiatric disorders that may be basically autism that folks have misdiagnosed.
Several years ago, I interviewed an author. He wrote a book contending that Thomas Jefferson had Asperger's syndrome. Is it possible for someone to be that high level, brilliant, a genius, and have a mild form of autism?
You know, it's possible. I think those some of the guys that that are extremely bright. Like I had a young man that I've worked with for years now. He's in his mid-30s, who actually placed out of mathematics classes at our local technical at NC State University. during 10th grade. So he had no more math classes to take, and he would do these complex math equations in his head and write the answer down because he saw it. He didn't have to think about it. And, you know, he did remarkably well in engineering, but I think the other years of his life weren't quite as good. And I think this is the kind of the tricky part, looking at historical characters and saying, do they have autism or not? Because they may have, but I think a lot of people are much more sociable and much more adaptable. And this is one of the things I think that gets in the way of some people with autism. They can be extremely bright, but yet the joke used to be that in physics and mathematics departments that there were a lot of people probably with high-functioning autism that couldn't get across the street but were brilliant in their field. And I think that's an exaggeration, but that's kind of an example. You get some really intelligent people who have marvelous skills, but they don't tend to do quite as well socially and quite as well occupationally as you think they might.
Can you generally make a diagnosis at 1 or 2 years, or does it take a while?
Well, I think if you talk to parents, they describe things that weren't, quote, right. It's hard for them to describe exactly what it was. This kid didn't respond as their other children might have. I think the general trend is to look at this as a diagnosis that probably solidified, and we can recognize between 2 and 4. And there may be some physiologic and brain change functions that will clue us in. Right now, there's a lot of emphasis on trying to define this disorder in infancy so we can do something about it and maybe intervene much more rapidly.
There have been discussions, as you know, probably more so than anybody else who's listening, about shots that kids get at an early age. Has there been any link at all correlating that with autism?
I think there was an early emphasis on the thimerosal, which was a component of some of the vaccinations. It's been difficult to pinpoint that because the numbers of autism, people with autism, have stayed the same in countries that didn't use this form of vaccination. I think the other thing, though, may be more complicated, is that there's a great or significant immune component. The immune system is active in people with autism. And so you've kind of learned in the field never say never, or to say this is an absolute certainty because it probably is not going to be. But I think there probably will be people that are exquisitely sensitive that may have had the pertussis was the one that has the most significant reaction in infants that may have had onset of some symptoms after that.
Dr. Jared Barnhill is our guest, professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and brought to the studio today by the good folks at the Pennington Biomedical Research Center. As far as drugs to deal with autism, are those getting better and more effective?
Well, I think there are two things that we're beginning to do. One is using the drugs we have more appropriately. And I think there are differences in how people with autism respond to standard psychiatric drugs. One's doses, and most people don't take very large doses of these drugs, and so it startles people to find out the low doses they're taking. I think the other was there was an overemphasis, I think, on antipsychotic drugs because of some of the behaviors, and there may be some real limits to what they're able to do. But I think the more interesting thing is going to be they're now looking at drugs that may alter how the brains and genes operate. And so hopefully 20 or 30 years from now, if we get smart enough, we may be able to interfere with some of the genetic problems that are there, intervene actually with the disease rather than treating just symptoms.
What is the count now as far as percentage? It's more prevalent in boys than girls, isn't it?
Yeah, I think if you look at the numbers, the milder forms of autism is at one point it was about 8 boys to every girl. So it's much more prominent in the milder forms of the disorder than the more severe forms, where it's probably 1 to 3 to 1. And I think that may in part be due to the fact that when girls have autism, oftentimes it's a fairly severe form of the disorder, and it also may be associated with intellectual disability or other neurological conditions. So it may be a more severe illness.
And you also deal with other types of things that may be in the same family as autism, like Tourette syndrome. We had a great basketball player here, you know, basketball in North Carolina, Chris Jackson, led the nation he was second in the nation in scoring as a freshman, and just a fabulous shooter. And he credited his ability, in fact, he holds the NBA record for free throw percentage, his ability to put the ball in the hoop by virtue of the fact that he had Tourette's. Repetitive things tend to go well with people who have this malady. But how many people actually have that?
again, it's one of those disorders that we probably have underdiagnosed. And the estimates have varied wildly. I think that the very severe forms of it, most people would recognize, they're extremely rare. There are very mild forms of it. I don't know where that's. Jackson had, we used to joke with my kids who had autism, we were talking about Jackson, that, you know, it's great to have a head jerk tick when you're playing basketball, because, I mean, that really sends everybody in every different direction. So it actually is to your advantage. But I think the milder forms is probably missed. And if you look in classrooms of little boys at 5 and 6 who have learning disabilities, mm-hmm. other kinds of problems, it may be 1 in 3 or 4. But by the time they're older, that may disappear. So Tourette's is kind of like autism. It's a big spectrum of symptoms and a big spectrum of severity.
Well, in Chris Jackson's case, I used to sit courtside, and he was a magician with a basketball, but he not only had the head tick, but sometimes he would utter expletives. And yeah. Like when they played Georgetown, these guys are just like, say what? You know, that they didn't take too well with that. Is that a common manifestation of it?
Well, in the old days, it used to be considered a primary symptom, as the new classification systems has been dropped, but it's called coprolalia. And it can really be embarrassing. I've had some kids literally almost get beaten up at school because they had a few words that people didn't like, and until they folks after a while realized, well, that's just him, and didn't pay any attention to it anymore. But it tends to pop up at inopportune times. And it's, you know, it's not like stubbing your toe and or hitting your thumb with a hammer and screaming. This would be right in the middle of a sentence that would come out, and so it would embarrass people to death. But you can trick people. There's a technique called habit reversal where you get somebody, instead of saying that word, say something else that relieves the pressure. And it just drives people crazy at schools, trying to decide, is he doing this intentionally to drive me crazy, or is he doing it involuntarily? And that's a dicey question sometimes.
Since we're talking about sports, the football coach at the University of Minnesota recently had to take a leave of absence because he has epilepsy, and he kept having seizures at game time. Usually people who have epilepsy today, they're quite functional, but in this case, it got to be too much. The seizures must often come about when somebody is under extreme pressure.
Well, I think so, and you know, sometimes missing sleep, not eating meals regularly, and football coaches are notorious for probably having a lot of bad habits. And I think that can be an issue, and what we've come to discover is we've got some awfully good anticonvulsant drugs, but there still seem to be people out there that have breakthrough seizures. And I do consulting work for our epilepsy surgery program at UNC, and these are folks that just know medicines have worked and end up having to do surgery on the brain to correct it. And most of them do extremely mm-hmm. well. But I think people will have breakthrough seizures from time to time, and a lot of times it's sleep deprivation.
Well, we've seen medicine advance so much. Dick Cheney's an example of how people are able to treat heart disease in ways that they could not before and keep people alive well beyond what they would have been a decade ago or a generation ago. Same kind of advances are they being made in the kinds of issues that you face on a daily basis?
There seem to be newer ideas coming along. And one of the problems has been we tend to think conventionally. We got a drug that works in a certain area, and so we start applying it to everybody. It's like if all you've got is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And I think now we're beginning to look at things that actually alter maybe the whole brain process, the whole genetic expression of a disorder, and that's where it's really getting exciting. And disorders like Fragile X syndrome, which is another developmental disability syndrome, right now looking at drugs that may alter the course of the syndrome. It's very, very early in the work, but if things like that come along, it'd be very promising for families.
What do you think the next 10 years will bring?
It's hard to imagine because I think we're probably not smart enough to do it. But I think we'll probably begin to see earlier and earlier recognition of things like autism, better and better behavioral and educational programs that work with infants. The original idea behind discrete trial learning or applied behavioral analysis that's used mm-hmm. on a lot of young people, very young people with autism. There are modifications of it. Right now, people are looking at infants' gaze preferences and things like this and beginning to intervene as early as possible. Because I think the brain's most plastic, it's most workable the younger you are. And that's the goal. And some of these drugs may actually turn the clock back.
Well, we thank you for joining us today.
Appreciate it.
Dr. Jared Barnhill from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill School of Medicine, the Department of Psychiatry, and a man who knows his stuff pretty good. And we thank you for imparting your wisdom today, and we thank the Academic Distinction Fund. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our guest is Dr. Stephen Lamb, director of the Men's Health Center at New York University Medical Center and the men's health expert for Today and The View. His book is Redefining Prostate Cancer, An Innovative Guide to Diagnosis and Treatment. Good morning, Dr. Stephen Lamb.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, there are, about 2.5 million men in the United States with prostate cancer? Either
yep.
they're survivors yep. or they're currently battling this this problem.
Yeah, so 230,000 guys get diagnosed every year, 30,000 of them die. So this is, unfortunately, a big-time disease, and there's a lot of confusion, a lot of chaos in this area. And the book really is an attempt, by myself and Dr. Herbert Lepore, who's the chairman of urology at NYU, and Dr. Sperling, Dan Sperling, who's a noted interventional radiologist and an expert in prostate cancer diagnoses, to really try to kind of make a roadmap for people, because it's extremely confusing. You hear about the treatments, shouldn't be doing them, they're too aggressive, the PSA is a bad test. It's really a very confusing area, and hopefully we're trying to clarify that for people.
Well, men, if they live long enough, are almost bound to get prostate cancer at
sure.
some point in their
yeah.
lives. So
yeah.
go ahead.
I think that the statement is that it's a great disease, a great cancer to live with, but it's a bad cancer to die with. And because when the prostate leaves the capsule of the prostate, it goes to your bones often, which is a very painful death. And so the issue is going to be, how do we help define which are the men that are likely to die with it as opposed to of it? And that we can then target those guys with very specific treatments at a stage where we could have cured them. So I think that's really what the real challenge is. And I think that, in the book we have a one-size-doesn't-fit-all kind of approach. So we really help define which men, based on their age and their medical history and everything else that we know about them, should warrant a more aggressive approach, and which should just not even be investigated, and not even looked at, because, the majority of guys who are diagnosed 10 years later are still going to be alive. So, we want you to outlive this prostate cancer stuff. So we help really redefine the approach. And I think that it's going to really be the approach, I think, that an increasing number of academic medical centers are going to adopt, that is, decide, how healthy and well the patient is. Should this patient be investigated? How do we utilize the PSAs? What kind of other modalities we use, like ultrasound or MRI? Can we target the biopsies through the MRI or the ultrasound? Can we then decide which patients, based on the biopsy, should be treated with radiation or with seeds or with surgery or with even laser, or not treated at all? So I think that it really, you can't just go, one size fits all and we do everything to the same way. It's not going to work that way anymore. It's a personalized approach to this disease. I think we should have personalized approaches to all diseases, and not just these paradigm shifts that, all of a sudden everybody should get this test and that test. I think that's
one of the... Well, what about a PSA test?
PSA is not specific for the prostate, but I think that based on your... Let's say you're 48 years old and you have a brother who died of prostate cancer. Of course I would do a PSA, okay? If you're 48 years old, no family history of prostate cancer at all, you're otherwise well, I wouldn't do a PSA. But
all right, well,
if
you have one and let's say you get a 3... Is that a bad number, or does it depend?
Well, here it's interesting. The standard is about 4, other than in those people who, for example, African Americans, where maybe that number has to be 2.5, or if 3, let's say it was 3 and you were 40, I'd be a little worried, but 3 at 60, I would be less worried. It depends on the age. So if let's say, or I was 48 years old, right, and you had a 3, okay,
yeah.
PSA. So what I would want to know is, have you had a previous PSA done, okay? And so if, let's say, it was 1 6 months earlier, I'd be a little bit more concerned, unless maybe, you have a little prostatitis or you'd had sex the day before the test, which can raise your PSA. I would then repeat it. Okay, I'd like to see whether or not that PSA changes significantly over time. So it was 1.5 a year ago. Now it's 3. Now I say to you, come on, let's abstain from sex for at least 48 to 72 hours. Come back in 6 to 8 weeks, okay? Now it's 3.4, okay? Let me get a little anxious about this, okay? And that's when the MRI now comes into play, because the MRI looks perfectly clear. I might would just watch this person, okay? If the MRI shows something, I would do a targeted biopsy, you know, because this is, there's something a little off in this patient.
Stephen Lamb is the director of the Men's Health Center at New York University Medical Center, practicing internist, well known as the house doctor on ABC's The View. He's been on places, shows like Today, Oprah, Nightline, Dateline, Fox News, and he has some previous works, including No Guts, No Glory, and Thinner at Last, and his latest is Redefining Prostate Cancer. Now, I've read and heard that biopsies may not be a good thing. When do you do a biopsy?
Yeah, really important. Not only is it may not be a good thing, but it may not actually not even find the prostate cancer because, you know, right now they're doing random biopsy and it's just like pin the tail on the donkey. You're going to miss it often enough, okay? So if you can then, and biopsies aren't benign. I mean, they can cause bleeding, they can cause infections, they're uncomfortable, there's a cost involved. Who wants that, right? But if you can define it on an MRI, for example, and you could stick a needle directly into that lesion, into that area, you have a great chance of targeting the disorder, okay? And that's really what this is about. It's really, we have to find those guys who have prostate cancer at a relatively young age who need to be aggressively treated. And we need to know who we shouldn't be aggressively treating, okay? I don't want to make somebody impotent who really has a disease that wouldn't have killed them to begin with or give them bladder problems. I want to find those guys who have an ugly, aggressive disease. And that's what all of us now are really, really trying to pursue. And I think over the next 3 to 5 years, using our technology and our techniques that we talk about, using genetic markers that will help look at the nature of these prostates and let us know who's likely to be have a problem, it's going to make a huge difference. We need, you know, the prostate cancer is not going away, okay? And so it's we want the prostate cancer deaths to go away, and that's what we're trying to aim for at these with our book.
Mm-hmm. Now, as far as the treatment and the side effects.
Some men don't need any treatment. How's that? I mean, you know, you can have cancer and say watchful waiting is a perfect approach. And it's because they're so slow growing. Some men really need surgery. Some men need radiation. Some men need can actually get what we call focal therapy, where we actually stick a laser right into the cancer and just treat it locally, and you go home. So there's once again, one size doesn't fit all. I mean, it makes doctors uncomfortable when there are a lot of choices. It makes patients uncomfortable. Let me tell you, it makes residents and medical students uncomfortable because they would like to be able to say, okay, you have this, you do this. Well, it doesn't work that way in medicine. Medicine's still an art, right? And you have to have a relationship with your doctor. You have to know where you are in your life, what's important to you, to define what the best treatment is.
What about erectile dysfunction? Is that always a problem?
Well, here's the problem. Well, it's a problem if you have it.
Well, I mean, is it a problem?
I know what you're saying. Here's the story. Because we diagnose it, this disease often in men in their 60s, men in their 60s often have erectile dysfunction to begin with, not necessarily from their prostate disease, but from their vascular disease, their diabetes, their heart disease, their cholesterol, hypertension. So a lot of these guys start out with erectile dysfunction. Of course, if you operate on them, you're not going to make it better, okay? So, you know, you have to know the likelihood is if you have really good erectile function to begin with and you have a nerve-sparing procedure, the overwhelming likelihood is you're going to maintain your erections, okay? In addition, you know, we have other treatments that will enhance your erections even if you develop erectile dysfunction. And, of course, you know, the ultimate is to have an implant in case you started with erectile dysfunction or you have complete erectile dysfunction after the procedure. You can always get an implant. So there's always options, but it's definitely a consideration.
When you say a nerve-sparing procedure, what are you talking about?
Well, you know, what happens is that in the old days, people would just lop out the entire prostate, okay? And over the last 15 years or so, they've developed what is called nerve sparing, where you actually just cut out the cancer, but you leave the nerves to the prostate area intact. and that preserves your erectile performance. So these, it's called nerve-sparing prostate surgery, and it can either be done robotically or openly, but you need the person who's the expert in the field.
Well, many men opt for the most radical procedures in hopes that their survival odds will increase. Is that always the best move?
No, it's not. It's not always the best route. No, I think that a lot of men, you know, can do equally well with some of the other modalities. And it's interesting, you know, the co-author of this book is Herb Lepore, who is a renowned prostate cancer surgeon. And even he doesn't recommend surgery in everybody. But if you need surgery, he'd certainly be a great person to have to perform your surgery.
What about a person who's diagnosed, Dr. Lamb, and the cancer is already outside the prostate? Is that basically a death sentence?
You know, I hate to ever say that to patients, but, you know, it is more disconcerting, and you have to hope that we continue to evolve newer treatments. And so there are treatment modalities for men who have disease outside their prostate, and they can also do very well for a very long period of time. I'm not saying we can necessarily cure everybody, but I think that, you know, with newer treatment modalities, you know, cancer today is now a chronic illness like a lot of other diseases. You just got to keep treating it and targeting and using new technologies. I'm very hopeful with some of the new treatments that are currently available.
Most men at some point in their lives will have an enlarged prostate. Is that a concern?
Well, it's a concern because it causes you to have urinary, you know, issues, and so you'll get up 2-3 times at night to urinate. And so, unfortunately, this is extremely common. And by the way, that's not really a symptom of prostate cancer for the most part. You know, most prostate cancers have no symptoms, but the enlarging prostate is, you know, all of a sudden you have an urgency to urinate and you can't even hold it in. So, you know, and that can be treated, and that can be treated very effectively. There are medications. There are all kinds of things that the patients can go to. So if you're having your, you know, bladder symptoms or urinary symptoms or erectile issues, or if you have a family history of prostate cancer, I'd urge you, go to your family doctor, go to the urologist, read our book. You know, let's have no regrets. That's what our book is really about, having no regrets.
What about smoking? Does that increase prostate cancer?
Good question. Smoking just is so bad that I wish I could lie to you and tell you it does. I think that, you know, there's some statistics that may suggest it, but the reality of smoking is just such a devastating problem that, you know, if it'll get you to stop smoking, I'll tell you that it causes prostate cancer. But, you know, we certainly know it causes heart disease and lung cancer.
I've seen reports about a link between either high or low testosterone and prostate issues.
Yeah, very, very interesting. You know, some of the guys with the lowest testosterone, you know, or, you know, have been associated with prostate cancers. And the thing is, high testosterone will promote the growth of the prostate cancers, you know, as opposed to necessarily causing them. So if you have a low-level prostate cancer and you take testosterone, it can stimulate the growth of the prostate cancer cells, absolutely.
But
that's why medicine is so difficult, you know, trying to figure out what the best thing to do for patients.
But on the other hand, there may be a link between low testosterone and prostate cancer.
The guys with the lowest testosterone sometimes have the most aggressive cancers. Isn't that interesting?
It is.
Sure.
So the cover of your book, Redefining Prostate Cancer, right at the top it says one size does not fit all. It's still an individual decision,
right?
Isn't it?
Absolutely. It's personalized care, personalized medicine. The book, I think, is a must read, in all honesty, for guys 40 and older, 45. Please get it for the holidays. Send it to your brother, your uncle, your father. You know, for $10, $11, you're really spending your money wisely. And I think we're not trying to sell anything. We're not trying to say one thing. We're trying to just explain and try to redefine this incredibly chaotic but unfortunately very tragic and common disorder.
What about incontinence?
Once again, I think incontinence, you know, can be a complication of the surgery or the treatments. And I think that, once again, there are treatment modalities. They're more and better and better techniques that, you know, sometimes incontinence occurs for the first 6 months or 3 months or 6 months until, you know, everything kind of corrects itself, especially with surgery. But once again, there's always, unfortunately, collateral damage in whatever treatments we offer people across the board, no matter for what disease. I mean, I treat your cholesterol, and I cause you to get muscle aches, or I treat, you know, your depression, and I cause you to gain weight. So that's part, unfortunately, of the collateral damage that occurs in the treatment of diseases.
Now, based on our conversation and your authority on this subject,
sure,
if I had an issue, I probably of this kind, I'd want to go to the NYU Medical Center. But what if I can't do that? Is treatment better in some places than in others?
Yeah, no. I mean, I've always liked the academic centers, you know, and I think that you know when you're in a big city now and you have a medical school and you have a university hospital, there's some great doctors in all of these centers. Okay, and that's not to say that your local doctor is not great. They might be, but you know, I think that, you know, if you're, you know, going to Tulane or you're going to Duke or you're going to Mass General, you're in Chicago. I mean, there are great doctors all over the United States, fortunately.
Well, a few things I wanted to run by you before we part company. As far as the emerging treatments, you mentioned something called CyberKnife. What is this?
Well, I just think that some of this, it's really more targeted. You know, the whole concept is to target the treatments. And so you try to localize the disease and target that, and so you don't radiate an entire, you know, area of healthy tissue, that you really define the site of the tumor and just treat it locally, just treat it at the site without the you know, the collateral damage where you're just radiating healthy tissue.
What about the proton beam?
Once again, those are all treatments that may be equally effective, you know, and some are associated with less radiation or less frequency of radiation, and certain centers specialize in different modalities that you just mentioned. It's hard to necessarily prove that any one is necessarily better than any other because, you know, honestly, in medicine, you know, there are no secrets, and so if one treatment is clearly defined as better, then we all have to do that. We can't, you know, let you get treated with inferior treatments, especially once there have been enough population studies to show that there's enough evidence that one is better than the other.
And you and your previous works have advocated physical fitness. Is that helpful as far as perhaps not getting prostate cancer?
I think that what they have actually shown is that, you know, a low-fat diet, low body fat, is really important. And if it's achieved through physical fitness, if it's, you know, I'm certain that stress is a contributor to all cancers and all heart disease. And so if you can reduce the stress level, you'd be well off. And, you know, I wish I could say to somebody, if you exercise and you eat well and you sleep well and you're happy, you're not going to get any of these diseases. I wish I could say that to you. But I can say to you that you're reducing your chances.
But ultimately, the biggest correlation, I'm told, is
maybe genetics.
Is genetics, who your,
yeah, maybe
who your
genetics.
Parents
Although,
are.
Yeah. I mean, we're not a prisoner of our genes, but it's definitely a factor.
Well, we thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Jim. Thank you for the time. I really appreciate
it. Well, you're a good man and
interesting
guest, Redefining Prostate Cancer, an Innovative
Thanks.
Guide to Diagnosis and Treatment. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. We're joined at this time by Attica Locke. She is the Baton Rouge Area Foundation's choice as the winner of this year's Ernest J. Gaines Award for Literary Excellence for her novel, The Cutting Season. The seventh year for the Gaines Award, created by the foundation donors to honor the outstanding work from rising African-American authors in recognition of its native son, Ernest Gaines, and his extraordinary contribution to the literary world. And with us is Attica Locke. Good morning.
Hello.
Nice to talk with you, Attica. The Cutting Season's your second novel.
It is.
You're a Houston native who graduated from Northwestern University, living in Los Angeles, and The Cutting Season is something that people in these parts can relate to.
Well, I should hope so. I mean, I was very nervous, actually, about writing about Louisiana, frankly, being that, you know, I'm not a native of Louisiana. Although I have to say I'm from, you know, my people are from deep East Texas. And I have said before that East Texas and Louisiana are kind of like fraternal twins. I mean, there's some through line there, and that's what I kind of breathed into and wrote about. I think if this novel had taken place in New Orleans, I think I would have even been more intimidated, because that's its own, you know, specific energy. But I felt like rural Louisiana, I could figure out.
Well, tell us about Karen Gray.
Karen Gray is a woman, a black woman, who grew up in and around Ascension Parish. And her family, her family's ancestors go back to slavery on this particular plantation, this fictitious plantation called Bellevue. And, you know, her ancestors were slaves, and then there were sharecroppers all the way up into when the plantation was owned privately by a family. Her mother was the plantation's cook. And Karen had a lot of shame about the legacy of not only slavery itself, but also just being the daughter of a cook on a plantation. And it was her dream always to get out of Ascension Parish and to get out of that life. And she fled to New Orleans. And the book is picking up at a time where she's had to come back, quote-unquote, home, so to speak, and now finds herself not only back on this plantation she wanted to get away from, but she's running it. She's the general manager of Bellevue, which has been turned into this kind of tourist site, much like the Oak Alley Plantation in Vacherie. I mean, that's really what I based this on.
The cutting season, I think it could be said, is a meditation on how we as a country, and perhaps Louisiana as a state, reckons on its past with its future.
Yes. And the thing about Southerners, and I am of a piece of that, but then Texas is its own thing. But there's a feeling for me that we brush up against the iconography of slavery and America's history in a way that if you're not living in colonial Williamsburg, you're not really thinking about it. I don't know that people in Detroit are walking around thinking about slavery, but we're literally driving past these spaces all the time if you live in the American South. And so I was really curious to see how people, exactly what you said, how you reconcile where we've been versus where we're going as a country. And also in that whole process, what do we make of these spaces? You know, should they be turned over for tourism? Is that appropriate? And what kind of tourism? Should you be able to rent out a plantation to have a party? Or should these spaces be more sacred? All of these questions were kind of turning up inside of me because I got invited to a wedding at Oak Alley. And it was one of the oddest experiences and also most emotional experiences I've probably ever had.
And why so?
I had never been on a plantation before. And frankly, you know, as a late 20th century black woman, had no interest in spending a Saturday as a activity to go tour a plantation. I very much was of the mindset that, look, I saw Roots, I get it. This is not my idea of recreation. And also, I never thought it would be done correctly. I thought it would be something whitewashed or simplified. So I just never, ever, ever, ever would have done it. And then all of a sudden, I get invited to this wedding. I'm here now. I mean, there's no way, you know, I'm not going to not go to the wedding. And when I stood on the grounds of Oak Alley, I burst into tears. I mean, the second I got into the parking lot, I started crying because it's visceral. I mean, to kind of step into that history is for me at least, it was a spiritual experience. And there was also the conundrum of why we were there. That we were there for a wedding, and it was actually a white guy and a black woman getting married, which is a mirror image of my marriage. My husband is white. So then I started thinking about, oh, is that what tonight is? Is that what this wedding is about, that we're going to kind of come onto this troubled land and remake it with love or remake it, excuse me, with hope? And yet during the course of this whole wedding, nobody mentioned where we were. It became very clear that the space had been chosen as a beautiful backdrop, stripped of its history. And I found that disturbing, curious. It just really, really stayed with me, that trip. And I ended up coming back to Oak Alley in 2009 after Obama was elected. I stayed in one of their cottages. And it was just, you know, for all of my talking about my discomfort at that wedding, it opened up a door for me to come face to face with my own history, and for that I'm very thankful.
What you experienced as far as people not taking heed of the past, perhaps ignoring it intentionally, you know, that's not that unusual, not in these parts.
No, no. And but it's been something that I, you know, could never fully participate in. There's no way as a Black American I could just go take a tour of a plantation and talk about the curtains and the china. It's not, that experience isn't really available to me. And so I avoided it just whole cloth, throw out the baby with the bathwater, without understanding that there's another level at which we can be appreciating the oak alleys of the world. That it doesn't have to be just, you know, you can have some people who want to go and look at, in the main house and talk about this kind of Tara and Gone with the Wind, antebellum grace. But the space also can provide, in my opinion, a way for all of us as a nation to kind of do whatever weeping we need to do to kind of move forward, so to speak. You know, this is a nation that never had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, that never had Nuremberg trials, that didn't have any national day of remembrance. We don't have any of that. But we do have these spaces. And I would hope that a lot of these tourist plantations would allow for the fact that some people need to come here and have almost like a Wailing Wall experience, and to be okay with that, even if it makes them uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. But I really think that these spaces are sacred, and I think that they can provide a vital role in the nation going forward.
We're visiting with Annika Locke. Her book is The Cutting Season. It follows a sensational debut novel that received all kinds of awards and recognition, Blackwater Rising. Before we get to how that may have changed your life, you've been a screenwriter for some time, haven't you?
I have been. I mean, and it's odd for me to even now use the past tense with it. I was a screenwriter for over a decade, and I was one of these highly paid, unproduced screenwriters that, you know, used to be, you know, a dime a dozen out here. It's not, the economics of it has shifted. I don't think that Hollywood studios, frankly, throw away as much money as they have in decades past. And they used to just spend millions and millions of dollars on movies that this never got made. And a lot of people made a great living off of it, and I was one of them. But as a writer, it started to chafe. It started to feel like my entire career was about writing to about 15 studio executives within a 10-mile radius of Burbank. Huh. And it had no value beyond that. And it was so, I just kind of came to a point of almost existential crisis that I just didn't understand what in the world I was doing with my life. And I just grew deeply disenchanted and came up with this idea to write a book. And I said I would give myself a year. I took a year off to write Blackwater Rising. I borrowed some money on my house. This was back when you could still do that. And and I wrote. I wrote for a year, and that was Blackwater Rising.
And what a success Blackwater Rising was.
You know, and at the time, the success to me was just that it was published, that it was, you know, you talked about how it may have changed my life. I mean, the part of it that most deeply changed my life was the writing of it, that it was a real transformative experience. I've said that second to motherhood, it was the single most transformative experience of my life, to turn myself into a novelist. I remember that year when I was working on it, I couldn't explain to people what a mountaintop I was climbing. All I could say is that it feels to me that this year is as big as the year I learned to walk and talk. I was really remaking, you know, my brain, so to speak, or remaking, you know, the way I look at the world and myself in it. And I just wanted something bigger, and I didn't know how to write a book, but I was willing to sit in the not knowing of it. So that was the most, that's the way that book changed my life. On the other side of it, the accolades were just kind of gravy and surprising, and then surprising in other ways, that the sales weren't better, or that, or just understand the economics of book writing coming from Hollywood, you know, which is a different economic model. I frankly thought I would have a pool, sir, which I do not. But you know, this has been one of the greatest privileges of my life, to write stories and be listened to and engage in dialogue. And I'm looking ahead at one of the next great privileges of my life, because when I found out about this award, the first thing for me was that I get to meet Mr. Gaines. I mean, that to me is it. I mean, I just, you know, will kneel at his feet, because I just think the world of him as an artist.
Well, he blazed a trail, and
yes,
his writing is brave and beautiful at the same time, and there's nobody quite like him, but you seem to be doing pretty well, and I'm sure that he has had an influence.
Well, very much so. I mean, I didn't know it when I started writing Blackwater Rising. I frankly, when I started that book, thought I was just going to be writing a slick little thriller. And then all of a sudden it became that. It is a slick little thriller, but it's infused with a great deal of history. And I can see the way in which, or what I'm reaching toward in terms of looking at Mr. Gaines' legacy, is that chronicling of, you know, late 20th century Black American life. And, you know, I'm beginning, I just finished my third book that I'm just beginning to work on with my editor, and it's something to see, I have 2 cents to, I have this other lens on late 20th century Black American life, and I get to add my voice to a larger dialogue. So, like I said, it's a real privilege to be a writer. It's a real privilege.
Well, you're still in your 30s. And
barely. Barely.
There's a lot of time to write more, find books. And Blackwater Rising, Attica, delivered one of the most stunning and sure-handed fiction debuts in recent memory. And now she has returned with The Cutting Season, a riveting thriller that intertwines two murders separated across more than a century, and it's based right here in our backyard, and that's where she will be when she comes to Baton Rouge soon to receive the award for this year, the Ernest J. Gaines Award for Literary Excellence for The Cutting Season. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks, and we look forward to book number 3.
Me too.
Take care. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody, and this month we have lost 4 prominent people in Louisiana who are known not only in the borders of our state but well beyond, including T.J. Jemison, the man who led the 1953 bus boycott in Baton Rouge, which became the model for the nation and certainly the model for the bus boycott that is better known in Montgomery. T.J. Jemison, who inspired generations with his leadership, his courage, and his tenacity. He died a few days ago at the age of 95 years old. We also lost former State Senator Mike Cross. He was on the Baker City Council from 1972 to 1976. He served as mayor of Baker from 1976 until 81. And then he beat Richard Baker for a Louisiana Senate seat. And Mike Cross was in the Louisiana Senate for 15 years. A fine gentleman, a controversial lawmaker, who was certainly passionate about his abortion stance, but he was a man who was always good with a quip, perhaps most notably calling the former governor, Buddy Romer, Little Pharaoh. Also dying this month, Joe Dean, the LSU athletic director from 1987 to 2001, the man who gave LSU its 2 greatest coaches as far as national championships in Skip Bertman. And actually he didn't hire Skip, but he kept him on. Skip Bertman won all 5 of his national championships, College World Series, with Joe Dean as athletic director. And Pat Henry, the man that Joe Dean hired as track coach in 1987, who won more championships than all the LSU coaches combined. Nick Saban was also brought to Tigertown by Joe Dean in 1999. And Edmund Reggie, the man who was instrumental in getting people elected to all kinds of offices and certainly was a big part of Edwin Edwards' career and was on board with John Kennedy in 1959. President Kennedy began his quest for the White House in 1959 in Rice Country in Crowley with Edmund Reggie at his side and with Edwin Edwards close by. Edwin Edwards was all of 32 years old, and amazingly, John Kennedy, who did not like to wear hats, wore a Rice hat when he appeared with Edwin and Edmund in 1959 as he was embarking on the 1960 campaign, which resulted in his election. This is a weekend of football. LSU plays Arkansas tomorrow. The Tigers are 25-point favorites over the Razorbacks, who have lost 11 straight conference games. LSU trying to go 9-3 for the regular season under Leslie Edwin Miles. And Southern University facing Grambling in the 40th Bayou Classic. It's been a tough year for Grambling. Southern's had a good year. Come Saturday in New Orleans, there will be thousands of Southern fans and Grambling fans on hand for the annual Bayou Classic, which has become one of the major staples in collegiate football. We hope you have a great Thanksgiving. Thank you for listening. We'll be back tomorrow. Until then, for Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.